It's a great pleasure now to introduce Dr. Kevin McFarthing. So Kevin has got a PhD in biochemistry and has worked over the number of years in the research and development of pharmaceutical companies. He's got a lot of experience of some of the things that I've been telling you about. And now he has developed his own consultancy business specializing in innovation and management.
Thank you, Christina. So good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, parkies and non-parkies alike. Welcome to the panel session on the promise of future therapies. As Chris Linda said, my name is Kevin McFarthing, and I was diagnosed with Parkinson's in 2012. As well as the 200th anniversary of the publication of James Parkinson's essay on the shaking palsy, 2017 is also the 20th anniversary of the identification of a protein called alpha-synuclein as a villain of the peace in Parkinson's. So it's quite an opportune time to ask three of our most distinguished players in the science of Parkinson's about the promise of future therapy. So I'm delighted to welcome Dr. Arthur Roach of Parkinson's UK, Professor Richard Wade-Martins of Oxford University, and Dr. Richard Wise from the Kew Parkinson's Trust. So now I'd like to ask each of them to briefly introduce themselves and to describe what they and their organisation do. Richard, would you like to start?
So I'm Director of Research and Development at the Cure Parkinson's Trust. We, like Parkinson's UK, we fund basic and clinical research. But we're more international. I'm running, I think, four trials here in the UK, but others around the world, and that's expanding rapidly. We're pretty intolerant of Parkinson's. We just think that it's about time we stopped its progression. A couple of months ago in The Lancet, the first trial we ever did was published, and that did slow disease progression in Parkinson's patients. Not all the patients in the study. It was statistically quite a strong study, but we're now working out what predisposes to a responder for that drug, stops them getting any worse over the year, and what predisposes for a non-responder. So we're working on that. We've got an international committee of about 15 experts in Parkinson's, and so far by next week we will have proposed 151 new treatments for Parkinson's, all disease-modifying, not symptomatic. And they prioritize, well, by the end of next week they will have prioritized about 40 to go to trial. We have a number of those in trial already, and some extremely promising therapies. I'm very optimistic that we'll be able to. Well, I think we already made a huge impact, but I think that impact is going to expand very quickly. I'm very optimistic.
Thanks. So, hi everyone. Very glad to be here. I'm Arthur Roach, Director of Research at Parkinson's UK. I'm a Canadian neuroscientist. I worked in the university world, but also I worked in biotech and pharma companies before coming to Parkinson's UK. I think many of you know Parkinson's UK. There's a lot of activity helping people live with Parkinson's in their communities, with their hospitals, with exercise and information about the condition. But funding research is also a very big part of what we do. I think if you just wanted to know how our research is perhaps a little different from some other organizations like Cure Parkinson's Trust or Michael J. Fox Foundation, we do fund a very significant amount of work in universities, including great deal of fantastic research here in Oxford that perhaps many of you are part of, so thank you for that. But with part of our research funding, we're taking the approach that if you look where new medicines usually come from, they actually do often originate some of the work, some of the most important work, happens in biotech companies and pharma companies. And so we believe if we're going to have a rich flow of new treatments for Parkinson's, we actually should be thinking about working a little bit more like a biotech, a little bit more like a pharma company, adopting some of their thinking, their techniques, and even their scientific experts. So we have our virtual biotech program where we try to bring new products forward, new treatments forward for Parkinson's, using the methods and the focus of the biotech and pharma sector. Thanks.
Hello, good afternoon. My name is Richard Wade-Martins. I head the Oxford Parkinson's Disease Centre here in Oxford, a large research programme funded by Parkinson's UK. We have a number of aspects to that. A little later on, you'll hear from my colleague Michelle Hugh, who leads the clinical cohort. Many of you are involved in that, so Thank you for your sterling efforts in supporting that. So we have a large clinical cohort which Michelle follows and works with, including brain imaging, studies of blood and studies of genetics to look for changes in early Parkinson's, including looking at sleep disorder in Parkinson's. And my own laboratory leads on a component of the work in which we make stem cells from skin samples, which we obtained from patients in the cohort. We can make stem cells, and then using stem cells, we can turn those in the laboratory to dopamine neurons, the type of neurons that are lost in the brains of patients with Parkinson's. And we can use those to understand what's wrong with the neurons, why those neurons, those brain cells are dying, and then start to look for molecules which might rescue those cells from dying. And the third component, we work with a range of rats and mice models which have Parkinson's, which can test out new therapies. And ultimately, we'd like to bring those therapies to complete the circle and test them in the cohort which Michelle is working with.
Okay, well, perhaps I'll kick off with the first question. There's lots of talk about a cure for Parkinson's, but what does a cure mean? Is it complete removal of all the symptoms? Is it a complete reversal of the disease? Or is it a replacement for what we've already lost? Or what?
So I'll kind of start with a comment. I think often the simplest idea about a cure is maybe derived from situations like infectious disease, where one has an infection. One gets an antibiotic, it completely removes the infection. One is completely back to where one was before one had the infection, and you say you're cured of the infection. So if that is the most complete and, let's say, rigorous definition of a cure, then I have to tell you, I honestly think we're a very long time before we'll have that level of a cure for Parkinson's, just because, as many of you know from the studies you participated in already, by the time we're aware someone actually has Parkinson's and is in need of some treatment or some cure, in fact, the condition's already progressed quite a far extent in certain brain regions. And it will be very difficult to completely regain everything from those brain regions. On the other hand, if we said, let's just stop the condition, like Richard said earlier, let's stop the progression of the condition at an early stage, when people can do relatively well, keep their jobs, keep their homes, keep their families, everything together, and stop the disease at that state, then I think that's a realistic and achievable goal, and that's, I think, something we all are very optimistic about achieving.
I think that makes a lot of sense. So I think Arthur's right. A complete cure in which you return somebody with advanced Parkinson's back to where they were 10, 20 years ago is unlikely. But I think the approach we're taking at our centre is you need to do two things in parallel to develop a treatment. First of all, Michelle and her colleagues work in the clinic not just with people with Parkinson's, but people we think who are very likely to get Parkinson's. So patients with, for example, very extreme sleep disorder called REM sleep behavior disorder have a higher likelihood to go on to get Parkinson's. So we study those individuals in depth and have identified as those we think are at risk of Parkinson's. We call them a prodromal cohort. They haven't got Parkinson's yet, but they're likely to. So working in parallel in my laboratory, we're looking to discover small molecules, potential therapeutic compounds, which would be able to preserve the cells that are left and prevent neurons dying. So you'd eventually bring those treatments together. You'd treat the people who haven't yet got Parkinson's with the protective therapies and therefore ultimately protect individuals from the onset of the disease. So essentially a cure looks like preserving function where it is, and the earlier you can do that, the better.
So I agree with pretty much everything that was just said there. My working hypothesis has always been, first, stop people getting any worse, wherever they are in their disease. That's a tremendous achievement if that can be done at all levels. How that transcends at the moment for our work is that we've done successful trials in patients that have had the disease for maybe 5 to 8 years. We've got more trials along the way. But I'm now moving them into very early part, soon after diagnosis. So for example, the Bigerian study, which was very successful, published in The Lancet a couple of months ago, I'm using 23 centers across France, in very early stage Parkinson's patients, because that's the natural home of a disease modifying therapy, when people are at their strongest and stop the disease progressing there. But of course that doesn't address most Parkinson's patients who are a little bit further down the line. So at the same time, we're expanding into studies which understand better the interface between symptomatic treatments and disease-modifying treatments. The Biogen trial that was very successful was in patients who were taking symptomatic therapy. And that symptomatic therapy dominated the effect of exenatide. When you took the therapy away for a night, the symptomatic therapy, then you could see that the exenatide was helping. So, but we can't, in practice, over millions of patients take their symptomatic therapy away. So it's really important to work on the interface of slowing the disease down in the context of people taking dopaminergic therapy, which of course traditionally goes up in terms of dosage over the years. Maybe one of our cures is to stop that increasing, and maybe we'll make it decrease. So if you like, there's the early stage Parkinson's patients and then there's a mid stage. We're also working on later stage Parkinson's as well.
I suppose in a way it's a bit like trying to change a tire while you're actually driving.
No, it's not.
Okay. I'll just stop then. Okay. Next question. There are around 200 different projects looking at cures for Parkinson's. I mean, obviously, Richard, you mentioned exenatide and bydureon. Which of the approaches excite each of you the most?
So the area of biology that we're most excited about is around the classic protein 20 years since discovery, involvement in the disease process called alpha-synuclein. This builds up inside neurons. It accumulates. It's not quite known whether this protein builds up as the neurons are dying or whether it's the last gasp of a neuron to survive. But ultimately, the role of alpha-synuclein is clear. It is detrimental to the cells. And we have a number of different approaches we're trying to target it. The reason it accumulates is probably because the protein recycling systems inside the cell, the recycling bins, if you like, are packing up and failing. So we need to be able to boost the activity of protein recycling to prevent the misfolding. If the cell can't fold it correctly, it ejects it out of the cell. So we need to increase the way the cell can handle alpha-synuclein. Another new approach we have going is what's called a molecular tweezer. So as the alpha-synuclein accumulates and has its toxic effects, there's the opportunity to sort of pick it apart with molecular tweezers. And we have approaches ongoing to sort of pick apart the synuclein and reduce its toxic effect. And that seems to have beneficial effects both on the cell, but also on the immune system in the brain, which might be negatively impacted by the synuclein. So a lot of our programs very much focused on the fundamental cell biology, improve cell function and try and clear out and reduce the effects of the toxic synuclein.
So when I went to med school and started using forceps, my mother said, they're tweezers, aren't they? Just never quite knew what tweezers versus forceps were, but there we are. So, I think that this is an extremely difficult disease to sort out. So as smart as you can possibly be, the best. Now, in terms of alpha, I don't know where to start because we've got 150 drugs which we're discussing to go to trial, and 30 or 40 of them are going into trial. So, you know, there's a lot of different targets here, but alpha-synuclein is really, in my view, vitally important. So there are a number of ways to see it's a protein which malforms, and then when it malforms, it touches other normal forms of that protein, and they malform, and it can go from cell to cell, and it does its evil work, shall we say? Well, we've got various ways to disaggregate it, get it out of the cell, stop it going from cell to cell by blocking that. There's various drugs that can tackle that process, and in concert with those different types of therapeutics, there are other things going on in Parkinson's. Like, anyone got any fatigue? You know, fatigue is a huge problem with Parkinson's, and that's because of a fundamental core energy problem within the cell as part of the Parkinson's process. So we have a number of drugs tackling this limitation of energy and energy provision. Bydureon, exenatide, works partly by that, but we've got some much more powerful drugs already in trial to at various hospitals around the world testing that. So it's a massive problem, and we are constantly surprised. About a week ago, there was a paper published looking at all Norwegians, and the relationship between taking inhaled puffers for their asthma and the incidence of subsequent Parkinson's. It protected by about 35 to 40% people getting Parkinson's. That's huge. Would it be beneficial when someone's already got Parkinson's? That's a very different question. Well, we've got this phenomenal international committee of experts. They're meeting next week. Are you there, Arthur? Okay. Normally at those meetings. And the lead author, Clement Scherzer from Harvard, is coming to that meeting. We're going to decide whether we're going to do a clinical trial with that drug. We've got 20 other drugs to discuss and other therapeutic approaches. So it's very difficult to give you a specific answer about, you know, because there's so much going on, and sometimes we're thinking of bringing them together as combination therapies to do more than the sum of the parts.
So, my answer would be, if I want to answer the question directly, I'd say I don't know. I don't know which is the most promising treatment. And that's why I think you hear what you're talking about, 20 or 30 approaches we have to try. And that's just talking about the repurposable drugs. There's another whole universe of completely new medicines that have never been used and can't be repurposed and have to be developed by, almost certainly by pharma companies. So I truly believe that to find the best treatments and the closest thing to the cure we're all looking for, we are going to have to make a lot of attempts, recognizing that some of those will not work out to be everything we hoped, but there's no other way to remove the uncertainty. If we knew the answer, we could just do one. That's the first part. Second part is I'll just put a plug in for a study that I think the UK should be very proud of, a made in the UK study, if you like. There's a growth factor called GDNF, which was discovered in the United States and invested heavily in by an American pharma company that eventually dropped the project, and it was going nowhere. Eventually, there were some people with Parkinson's in the UK. There was a neurosurgeon in Bristol. There was Cure Parkinson's Trust in Parkinson's UK, who came together with a great team at the hospital in Bristol to conduct a really first-class trial of using this very difficult approach, injecting GDNF as a protein deep into the brain of people with Parkinson's and looking for effects. And what's promising about that trial, we'll see the results published very shortly. There have been some suggestions at scientific meetings. But before the end of this year, you should see the results from that trial. I think you'll see there's some real reason for hope there. And I think it's particularly exciting that this was something that the rest of the world had given up on, and a real combination of a great community of people, hospitals, doctors, and societies with Parkinson's in the UK came together to make it happen.
You talked about early diagnosis. How is that possible? Because there are very few neurologists, and now the neurologists that do look at Parkinson's are now called movement disorder. Quite often the neurologists you see haven't got the foggiest idea what they're talking about. Then once you've gone through seeing a neurologist that actually gives you Parkinson's, you then don't see them. You see a nurse who now you only see when you want to see, when you're changing medication, which you don't change because you don't see a neurologist. How do you get early diagnosis with no neurologists?
Shall I take that? Yeah, it's an important point. You're absolutely right. So This is a structural healthcare system problem, and it's different from country to country. So what's happening at the moment is if you went to your GP about your ingrown toenail, he would look at you and he would think, okay, male, this age, have I checked his cholesterol and his blood pressure and over the last few years? And there'll be a guideline for you to be checked. Now, if she, the photographer there, went into the clinic, into her GP, for an ingrowing toenail, he wouldn't even think of measuring her cholesterol and blood pressure because it's not part of a guideline, a national guideline. So as we start to develop the prodromal cohorts and we're looking at early stage patients and we get treatments which are tangibly slow disease progression, then we can go to the government and say, when a GP sees a patient like this, think Parkinson's. Get them this test, this sniff test or pressure test or whatever it is, or asking about their sleep or you know, the various other aspects, and there'll be a way to pick them out of the community. I'm trying to start about 8 clinical trials in Australia and New Zealand at the moment. And we have exactly that issue because, you know, GPs are scattered across the deserts and, you know, it's difficult to pick up patients really early. But we want to study the very early patients. They're not going to come out of the healthcare system. They're coming out of us contacting the GPs and asking them for early referrals. But it's a structural healthcare national problem. It's not a research and development issue that we professional researchers can deal with. Although we do go and change laws in Parliament, and you know, but that's only one country out of 220. So in context, it's a structural healthcare system problem, which we may all need to work on when we're able to offer something tangible for early stage patients.
So I'll add another aspect to that. I was just in Geneva, actually, where the airport, the streets, the bus shelters are all plastered in posters in English, telling people if you want to have a medication, go to see your dermatologist because it's a new psoriasis medication. And that was reminding me of the power of marketing. When there is right now, if we diagnose people early, we actually don't have a treatment to offer them. We don't know actually what we would do to slow the progression or slow the development of their Parkinson's. If we had something that we knew worked, there would be a huge effort to identify those people. The pharma companies would be out there drumming up interest amongst GPs. Look, if your patients have this, there's a possibility for a treatment. You must diagnose them properly. So I think the recognition and the resources and attention to early diagnosis would be, in addition to the policy and healthcare financing issues that Richard identified, they would be greatly ameliorated if we had the treatment available to do something with those people.
Is that a big motivation for pushing better earlier diagnosis would be, as Arthur said, if we had a potential disease-modifying therapy to give. So as Michelle, I'm sure, will tell you about a little later on in her talk, we're developing different ways to get the better earlier diagnoses, one of which is to provide people in our cohort with smartwatches and smartphones, which are collecting the movement and gait and posture and tremor data through accelerometers and gyroscopes in the phones, to collect that data together. And if you can collect such data through the phones and the watches several times a day, several times a week, we're going to get a much better picture of a person's Parkinson's, which will allow you to give a better diagnosis, but also allow you to do better clinical trials with fewer people more quickly to be able to get to drugs to approval.
Thanks very much. I'm recently diagnosed 3 months. And I've just flown over from Ireland because same problem in terms of lack of multidisciplinary approach in Dublin. But I just wanted to ask about trials in, you know, if you're Irish, can you do any of the trials? You know, we have a group of young Parkinson's patients who I think would be very interested in getting involved in trials. So that's one question. I have a whole list of them. But the other thing is in terms of the alpha-synuclein, is there any kind of trials around the microbiome, because there seems to be some link between the gut and the brain axis, and is there something being developed around that? So I have a whole load of other questions. But in terms of as therapy, do you feel in my lifetime that there will be something that will, you know, slow progression? Because, and this is the last question, and I know there's lots here, but my symptom, I picked it up myself, is micrographia. That's my main symptom. I had to go to the GP, and I basically told him this is what I think it is. I had to go through a whole load of, I was pregnant at the time, but I had a DAT scan, which eventually confirmed it because my symptoms were so minimal. So just going back to, you know, research, is there any research around micrographia as a point of picking up early diagnosis? So I know there's a lot there. So if you can answer any of them, that would be great.
So I'll say something about the information about clinical trials and what's available to participate in. Parkinson's UK views this as a very big part of its mission. We have actually people in the research division. That's their entire job, is finding out about trials that are available and matching them up with people in the UK who want to find out about trials. So we are launching shortly, I wish I knew the date, I don't, a website where you can put in your postal code and find out about what's available in the area. That should actually eventually include not only opportunities to participate in clinical trials, but also many, many other things that could be of interest to people with Parkinson's. So watch the Parkinson's UK website, I think, for that. In the meantime, there's something we run called the Research Support Network. If you join that, it means basically you're on a mailing list, an emailing list, and you get emails about opportunities to participate in research all over the UK, both being a participant in a trial, but also there are volunteers in that organization that help us, for instance, work with a company that wants to do a drug trial. They actually have never worked with Parkinson's before. They don't know what a person with Parkinson's can do in a scanner. They don't know what a person with Parkinson's, how often they can come to the clinic. And so we help them design their trials to work better. So any interest in research, the RSN is a very good place to start. I recommend that. Let's see. Research into micrographia, I can't think of a particular study on that at the moment. And what the other question?
So there's a lot of gut biome research going on at the moment, and we've got some pet theories. They'll need to be proven. Are we doing studies in Ireland? Are you north or south? What? Southern. Yeah, we are talking to someone about setting up a trial there. I'm almost certain it won't be a biome trial, but it may be something that interests you. Are you part of Fox Trial Finder?
No, we're not part of it, but there's
Yeah, so there's a Fox Trial Finder as well. Michael J. Fox have got a Trial Finder website, and that you may find that helpful as well.
The gut is very complex. So there has been quite a lot of publicity and quite a lot of few findings in the last two or three years that suggests that alpha-synuclein may first start to accumulate or aggregate in the gut. It then may travel over years up the vagal nerve to the brain and up and lead to pathology later in life in the brain. This is really difficult to show, but people are working on it. One finding that some laboratories have found difficult to replicate is, therefore, you might be able to do biopsies of the gut to find very early stage synuclein changes there well before it's caused pathology in the brain. We find that difficult to reproduce because you really need to be able to take a very good sample of the gut that's best done at post-mortem, not as a biopsy, to be able to show that. So the jury's really out as to whether aggregated synuclein in the gut might be a biomarker. The biggest concentration of alpha-synuclein in the body is in the blood. So you just think how much alpha-synuclein is in a steak, right? So it's really complicated to understand the role of the gut biology. There's no less Parkinson's in vegetarians, so it's complicated. But maybe synuclein pathology does start in the gut years beforehand. It's still a hypothesis. I don't think it's been shown.
Gentlemen, as I understand it, there's a Canadian company that's produced a dopamine gel. Is that correct?
There's a dopamine gel. I don't know the Canadian company.
I believe it's on the GGNF trial for the brain, and I understand that there's evidence that it's reformed some of the cell structure around the dopamine receptors.
So, yeah, the GDNF trial is a trial I mentioned earlier. It's not a gel. It's a growth factor.
Medgenesis is a Canadian company.
Right, Medgenesis is a Canadian company based in Victoria. They're the fifth partner, if you like, for that trial that I mentioned was predominantly made in the UK. I didn't mention the Canadians, but we'll let them be honorary British for today.
There's no results to be published yet.
Yes, there are. There are results to be published. They were presented at the Academy for Neuro, the Movement Disorders Society meeting. Happened to be in Vancouver, no connection, but in Canada earlier this year. And they're being submitted for publication right now, and we're very hopeful that they'll see the light of day before the end of the year. And incidentally, there's a BBC, or there's a documentary about the participants in that trial, not the scientists, not the companies, but the people in the trial and what they went through, a two-hour documentary that's been prepared and should be aired around the time of the results being published. So we hope towards the end of this year, and I think you'll find that very interesting. So there are results. There is reason to be hopeful. I can't tell you the details today because the publication hasn't occurred, but do watch for it. And Parkinson's UK will be making a lot of noise about it, and it'll be on the website, and you'll get emails.
I'm very interested in that particular thing, but I'm at the maximum of my dosage, I'm told, and I've got to consider a duodenal duodopa. Mm-hmm. I've noticed that when I've been working hard, especially this summer in Europe, I was able to travel and drive 1,594 miles, and I came back to my neurologist boasting about that. And he said, well, I won't see you for 3 months, I'll see you for 6 months. And after that, I collapsed, and I realized that I was on adrenaline. And have you considered what the body is doing when you overcome the Parkinson's systems? Symptoms like I did driving.
All the time, Richard.
Yeah, it's a tough question. I think what your one very interesting point that your comments raised for me is the difficulty in making assessments, reliable, scientifically valid assessments on how a person is doing when they come into the hospital for one visit every 6 months or every 4 months. A person can be on adrenaline. Maybe the nurse is extremely pretty. Whatever the reason is, the person may do very well and much better on that day than they do the next day when they're at home, and it may be unrepresentative. This is why I think the devices, the wearable devices that Richard mentioned that you're going to hear about later, that Kristalina showed, where you can wear something, and it will show you when you're on adrenaline, when you're not on adrenaline, give a much truer picture, and that will make it much easier for us to identify the treatments that really work, which is very important.
Hi. Thank you so much. It's fascinating to have three experts talking about Parkinson's research. One of the frustrations for people with Parkinson's is obviously the frontline medicine for Parkinson's is levodopa. It's the same frontline medicine as it has been for 60 years, and it seems a little bit frustrating to people like us that there's nothing really very new. You kind of alluded to a number of trials. There are a number of trials in stage two, which I think could be interesting. I was just wondering your opinion of those. One of them is from Oxford Pharmaceuticals, which is Prosavin, and NT-Cell, which is, the results aren't out yet, I know. But if they get through stage two, they're talking about bringing these drugs or these therapies within 2 to 3 years. Is that reasonable? Are we looking as hopefully as that? Or is the picture a little bit darker than that?
So the to have medicines widely available, they have to be approved by the MHRA based on extensive testing for safety and efficacy in specific populations. And usually that takes more than 2 years beyond phase two for Parkinson's. However, when there's a new medicine that brings a new and unique benefit that's not available any other place, then there are expedited processes and there's compassionate review and there are different approaches. So if the results were sufficiently positive and clear and exciting, then it's quite possible the regulators would make exceptions to make things available earlier. That being said, Prosavin's a very difficult treatment to make and deliver, and one couldn't scale it up to treat everyone in the UK overnight. But the timelines are usually long. Everyone wants to bring new medicines forward that are really effective and important, including the regulators, and they will make exceptions and try to move things forward. Don't know if that's
Anyone can add to that?
I think PRO7 is very exciting. So it's a different type of therapy than we've talked about mostly today, which is around small molecules. PRO7 is a gene therapy in which a virus has been engineered to deliver the three key genes needed to make dopamine. So the idea is it can be injected into the brain and will get those genes into the neurons that remain and secrete a steady amount of dopamine in the brain, which will avoid the peaks and troughs associated with periodic taking of L-DOPA. So it's potentially a very exciting therapy developed here in Oxford, and it has many advantages. It's a unique approach. As Arthur said, it's not easy to generate in large amounts and treat everybody. But I think it's an important example of the breadth of different approaches people are taking to cure Parkinson's. So there's the gene therapy approach, there's the growth factor approach, the GDNF, there's the small molecules, and also vaccinations. So, you know, there are many different approaches ongoing, and we don't know which one will be successful. PRO7 is an interesting example for the gene therapy.
I'd like to say a quick word about L-DOPA that you mentioned, because you know, you're absolutely correct. It's not a new medication. It's been the mainstay for many years. But is that a good or bad thing? I mean, it's fantastic that this medication, which is, I think, more effective than what's available for any other neurodegenerative condition, has been available to people with Parkinson's for so long, number one. Number two, in those 50 years, things actually haven't stood still. The way L-DOPA is used, its effectiveness, how we manage the side effects, complementary medications, all have improved enormously over those 50 years. The first trials with L-DOPA were regarded as failures. Forget it, it's not working. We can't use this stuff. It's terrible. It took years before people learned how to use it, and better, now we even have DuoDopa as a, you know, the intestinal gel as a very advanced way of giving it. It's being tested as an inhaled delivery. So there have been huge improvements even with L-DOPA, and we still need a lot more, and we need better.
So the problem of everything takes a long time to come through to be through clinical trials. Therefore, the reaction, the action of teaching consultants in neurology of fatigue and various other problems that one has with Parkinson's and MS would be very useful, because Australia has a very good Disability Discrimination Act, America has a reasonable one, and England has the Disability Discrimination Act, which is as much use as a chocolate teapot. So what we need is consultants that are actually A, versed in what they're talking about, and B, the government start to include the Parkinson as a disability, because currently it isn't.
Some very good points there. We have one final question over in the corner. The lady there.
One of the things that I keep coming across, and is kind of causing me some worry, is the preamble that people often give when they're talking about research is, well, you know, bringing new drugs to trial is so expensive, it's 15 years or whatever, and therefore we're looking into repurposing trials. So that begs the question, is there enough investment being made into research by the pharma company? Is there enough money being put into it? Has there been a drop in the amount of money that pharmaceutical companies are prepared to put into it? And that worries me, and it'd be quite interesting to find out whether that's the case, because I think ultimately it is about money. And then the second question that comes out of that as well is, has there been setbacks as a result of, say, for instance, the politics in America where fetal cells were not allowed to be used? Is that a problem for us in terms of going forward in cures? Thank you.
So certainly I've seen firsthand a reduction in investment in Parkinson's research in the company I used to work in. The pharma industry is becoming more and more competitive, and everyone is specializing in what they do best and do uniquely well. And for the big companies, they're now saying what we do best and uniquely well is late-stage development, not early stage. So they want less and less to invest in creating new medicines. They're quite happy to jump. We're fortunate, and Richard will know this, we're fortunate that they're still ready to jump in at the last stage. If they see that, aha, here's something, whether it's GDNF or something else that maybe has only 3 or 4 years to go, they'll often will jump in then and make very major investments. So that is the way Parkinson's UK views this is, in that reality,
What we have to do is step into that early stage, get other people to join us there, do that work very well, and then present it to Big Pharma and say, here's a great project, could be very successful for you all over the world. Now we need you to do your share and invest your last $50 million or whatever it is. And that's, you know, the approach we're taking to try to bring everyone in and give them a reason and opportunity to do the right thing and invest in Parkinson's research. So far, we see some signs of success, but things take a long time.
So pharma has been reducing its input into the early stage discovery science in neuroscience at the moment. But that means there's an increased opportunity for academic-led research as well. So we now have a number of biotechs and pharmas that come asking us, you know, what do you think, how about this project, trying to get input and ideas, because pharma has been trying for a long while and is a little short of new approaches. So as pharma pulls back from that early discovery stage science, there's a big opportunity for academia to step in.
So you might want to talk to me later. There's a lot going on, but particularly on the regenerative medicine side, which is 2018 is going to be a tremendous year for that because various FDA things are now maturing. In terms of funding, our own clinical trial program is entirely held up by our ability to get them funded. So we'll have about 35 to 40 trials to do. We've got, looks like we're going to raise about 30 million in Australia, which will fund about 8 trials, maybe a couple in China. But, you know, it's piecemeal. French government has given us some money, some other people, you know, so it's every single drug is a fight. Fortunately, we've got 4 pharmaceutical companies, early stage compounds, just we are doing early stage compounds. And we think about 4 of those companies will be funding those trials. So it's piecemeal, but I think we would have launched at least 15 trials by now if we had had the money 2 years ago to do it. So we're just trying to raise the money all over the world to do that. You know, we've got some fantastic treatments. Well, let's get out there and prove them.
I think Arthur, Richard, and Richard will be available hopefully at the break to answer some more questions. I'd like to thank them on 2 levels. First of all, for giving their time to us today to come along and talk. But secondly, these guys are representative of a very large number of people who are passionate, dedicated, and committing an awful lot of time and money to helping us. So they're spending all of their time to give us a better future. So I'd like to thank them for that as well.